KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The U.S. Army veteran who killed 14 people in New Orleans last week had pledged allegiance to ISIS. We'll hear how the terror group is adapting their tactics. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The interim government in Syria faces lots of challenges. Among them are widespread hunger and higher prices on bread. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. We'll hear the concerns of Syrians waiting in line outside bakeries in Damascus. Also, excerpts from a 2007 NPR interview with former President Jimmy Carter talking about the difficult question he faced after not winning re-election, what to do with the rest of his life. It's Tuesday, January 7th. Baltimore Ravens quarterback and two-time NFL MVP Lamar Jackson turns 28 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Corva Coleman. The body of former President Jimmy Carter will be moved to Washington, D.C. today. Steve Futterman says Carter has been lying in repose at the Carter Center in Georgia.
The body will be removed this morning from the Carter Center here in Atlanta and taken to Dobbins Air Reserve Base. The flag-draped casket will be placed on one of the presidential jets. For this flight, the plane will be referred to as Special Air Mission 39. Once in Washington, the body will be placed on a horse-drawn caisson and travel along Pennsylvania Avenue and Constitution Avenue to the Capitol. Military body bearers will take the casket up the Capitol steps to the rotunda, where Jimmy Carter's body will lie in state.
Steve Futterman reporting. Carter's state funeral is set for Thursday at Washington National Cathedral. President Biden visited New Orleans yesterday to grieve with families of the victims from last week's attack on Bourbon Street. Biden lit a candle at a prayer service. It was just blocks away from where a driver had plowed into a crowd of people celebrating New Year's Day. 14 people were killed and dozens of others were hurt. The Biden administration is now granting a higher security threat rating for Mardi Gras in New Orleans. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports the city requested the security upgrade.
New Orleans Mayor LaToya Cantrell sought the highest potential threat designation. It's used for events with national or international importance that require extensive federal interagency support. She's also asking the White House to provide a tactical expert to review the city's security plans. Mardi Gras season is underway and the Super Bowl comes to New Orleans next month. City leaders are facing scrutiny for not completing repairs to safety barriers in the French Quarter before New Year's. Louisiana Attorney General Liz Murrell is ordering a state investigation into security plans to determine what was done and not done and what needs to change. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
Chinese media say at least 95 people have been killed by a powerful earthquake today in Tibet. The U.S. Geological Survey says the quake's magnitude was 7.1. NPR's John Ruwitch reports rescuers are trying to pull out people trapped in the rubble.
The quake struck a little after 9 a.m. local time, and USGS registered several substantial aftershocks. The epicenter was high in the Himalayas, some 50 miles north of Mount Everest. The earthquake rattled Tibet's second biggest city, Shigatse, the center of which is over 100 miles to the northeast. Photos and videos online showed collapsed walls, rubble in streets, and overturned vehicles. Shigatse is the site of a major Buddhist monastery that's the traditional home of the Panchen Lama, the second most important spiritual figure in Tibetan Buddhism after the Dalai Lama. John Ruwitch, NPR News.
The quake was also felt in northern India. You're listening to NPR. It's been 10 years since armed men attacked the offices of the French satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo in Paris. 12 people were killed, including some of France's most popular cartoonists. The attackers, who were killed, said they supported Al-Qaeda. French President Emmanuel Macron helped lead a memorial service today. Pope Francis has selected a vocal critic of President-elect Trump as the new Archbishop of Washington, D.C. NPR's Jason DeRose reports on the Pope's choice of San Diego Cardinal Robert McElroy to the post.
Cardinal Robert McElroy has led the Archdiocese of San Diego for nearly a decade. During that time, he became known as a critic of the first Trump administration's immigration policies and has continued to speak out against Trump's intentions during his upcoming term. Specifically, McElroy called the Muslim ban religious prejudice and mass deportations gravely evil. He says Catholics should oppose such deportations with the same energy they give to abortion. Shortly after Trump's first inauguration, he called on Catholics to become disruptors. In San Diego, Robert McElroy is also known for his work toward inclusion of the LGBTQ community. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
Parts of the central and east coasts are recovering after a huge winter storm piled snow and ice on the region. Hundreds of thousands of customers from Missouri to New Jersey lost power. Meanwhile, the National Weather Service is warning people in the Los Angeles area of powerful winds today. Forecasters say these could reach hurricane strength and be life-threatening. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The Islamic State group has increased its activities in Iraq and Syria, and the New Orleans truck attacker is said to have pledged allegiance to the group. We'll speak with a former senior U.S. State Department official about whether ISIS is resurging.
First, though, Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has announced that he is resigning, capping almost a decade in power.
The 53-year-old faced calls from all corners of the country to step down over his handling of the economy, immigration, and other issues. Now, it's a far cry from 2015 when he was first elected in a landslide.
NPR International Affairs correspondent Jackie Northam has been following Trudeau's rise and fall over the years, and she's with us now to tell us more about it. Good morning, Jackie.
Morning, Michelle.
Jackie, there have been calls for months now for Trudeau to resign, even from members of his own Liberal Party. What happened?
Well, momentum had been building for some time for him to step aside. His poll numbers in the parties are in the low 20s. A couple of weeks ago, Chrystia Freeland, who was both his deputy prime minister and finance minister, resigned. And she had been a key, steadfast ally for Trudeau. And frankly, he faced a no-confidence vote. And it was pretty clear he was going to lose that, and he likely wanted to get ahead of it. So he announced his resignation.
This is quite a fall for somebody who, you know, more than 9 years ago had a landslide victory during his first run as prime minister. Just tell us more about him.
Well, you're right. I mean, he won by a landslide. You know, he had or has matinee idol looks. He was tall, athletic. His face graced the covers of magazines around the world. And he just energized the 2015 elections, and he had broad appeal for voters, especially young voters. It was the same type of popularity that his father, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, had, and he was twice prime minister, and he was also a charismatic figure. Justin Trudeau also promoted social causes such as gender equality, and there was an equal number of women and men in his first cabinet. Also, more taxes on the wealthy, more effort protect the environment.
So a progressive agenda that the public seemed to embrace at the time that he was elected and seemed warmly embrace it. What happened? Why has he become so unpopular?
Well, within a few years of first being elected, it was pretty clear that the honeymoon was over. There were scandals, resignations in his cabinet. Now, he did get good marks for his handling of the COVID pandemic, but, you know, the country never really seemed to rebound. And Canada now is experiencing many of the issues that we see here in the U.S., high inflation, housing shortages. I spoke with Nick Nanos with Nanos Research, which is a leading polling firm based in Ottawa, and he said that there was also a backlash against immigration. Here he is.
Although Canadians are supportive of immigrants, they were not supportive of the level of immigration that the Liberals had. And this created a significant stress on the housing market. It put significant stress on the healthcare, education.
And you know, Michelle, all of these issues came together and affected Trudeau's popularity.
And this decision to resign comes just as President-elect Donald Trump is due to head back to the White House in the U.S. The two leaders have not had the best relationship. So what is the next Canadian leader going to have to deal with?
Well, you're right. It's never been an easy relationship between the two leaders. And since the presidential election, Trump has been needling Trudeau, suggesting Canada become the 51st state and calling Trudeau a governor rather than a prime minister. And more importantly, Trump is threatening to impose 25% tariffs on many Canadian products. Now, Trudeau will still have to deal with Trump as he's staying on as prime minister until the Liberal Party chooses a new leader. But it's quite likely that Trump will be dealing with someone from the Conservative Party after that.
That is NPR's Jackie Northam. Jackie, thank you.
Thank you.
Investigators say the U.S. Army veteran from Texas who drove into a crowd in New Orleans last week pledged allegiance to the Islamic State group. ISIS fighters are scattered and its operations are decentralized, and yet the group has ramped up attacks in Syria and Iraq and taken advantage of regional instability in Africa. So is ISIS resurging, or are the group's tactics just evolving? Aaron David Miller is senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the State Department's former deputy Middle East coordinator. Aaron, so, I mean, how do you assess the current state of ISIS right now?
You know, I think 5 years after the last piece of the ISIS caliphate, which at one time controlled more than 10 million people in Iraq and Syria, were stripped away by coalition forces. I guess I describe the situation as ISIS being down, but not out. As you suggested, ISIS continues to exert significant influence in various places, Afghanistan through ISIS-K, ISIS Khorasan. You pointed out sub-Saharan Africa, particularly in the wake of these coups in Mali and Burkina Faso and in Niger. ISIS feeds on instability and weak governance, and also on government repression. And in Syria, I think, without a doubt, there's been a resurgence. If you ask me, do I think ISIS constitutes right now an imminent or immediate threat to the homeland? I don't. But I think their tactics have changed in some respects to a much more difficult sort of approach to killing, and that is ISIS attacks through inspiration. That's what appears to have happened, although we don't know much about Jabir's relationship with us, ISIS online. We may learn more, but it's the digital caliphate, as some people describe it, that may provoke the real challenge for American officials.
Wondering, Aaron, considering that last week's attack was at least inspired by ISIS, why do you think ISIS has not at least claimed some responsibility for it?
You know, they don't always, particularly for attacks that are inspired, they may still. So I don't think I have a really good answer to that. I mean, you would like to think that the Islamic State understands the downside, the consequences of actually killing Americans or being associated with operations that do that. I mean, in the last 2 weeks, the U.S. launched intense strikes against ISIS targets in central Syria. But hard to imagine, frankly, if they are in anywhere associated with an attack on the homeland killed Americans, that they wouldn't at some point want to associate themselves with it.
You mentioned that ISIS thrives on instability, and considering what's going on in Syria right now, are they ripe for being maybe a place where ISIS can move in?
You know, the good news, I think, is that the Assad regime is gone. But the Assad regime did, in fact, create something of a constraint on ISIS activities. You now have areas in central Syria which are controlled by no one. The real test, I think, here is whether or not the new Syrian government can figure out a way to create a functional, inclusive government that includes minorities, women, to eliminate the notion that they are going to repress. That would be, frankly, in the end, and in addition to good counterterrorism strategies by that government, aided by their supporters, would probably be the best way to contain this group.
What might change when Donald Trump is inaugurated in terms of how the U.S. tries to contain ISIS worldwide?
You know, it's really hard to say because it really depends on what the president-elect's policies on Syria are going to be. Is he going to redeploy the 2,000 American forces, which do play a role? Is he going to stop support for the Syrian Democratic Forces, which monitor and maintain the administration of at least 12 prisons in which you've got an estimated 10,000 ISIS fighters still in captivity? And I think both of those things would be a mistake. Will he impose a Muslim ban, which is going to be a red flag, as he did in Trump 1.0? I think we don't have to own Syria, but we do, in fact, have to take some responsibility for trying to keep it stable and pursue effective counterterrorism. And I'm hopeful that he will.
Aaron David Miller is Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Aaron, thank you.
Thanks so much, James.
It's Christmas this week for tens of millions of Orthodox Christians around the world who celebrate the holiday in January. In Lebanon, NPR's Emily Fang tells us the celebrations take on special significance this year.
Bells tolled across Beirut and civil servants had the day off. Less than one-tenth of Lebanon's diverse society is Orthodox Christian. But in a country that loves Christmas, the Orthodox version is a public holiday. Here at the Beirut Armenian Apostolic Church, the faithful celebrate Christmas on January 6th. Elsewhere, Orthodox Christians consider January 7th the true holiday, a divergence in dates due to the Julian calendar, used since the time of Julius Caesar, that the Orthodox faiths still go by. On the white marble steps of the church, George Gulisarian reflects on his parents' love story that brought him here to these very steps. His mother was actually born in neighboring Syria.
She was born and raised in Aleppo.
But while studying in Beirut, she met his father.
They married here, and I was born there.
And so, like many Lebanese people, Gulisarian has family who live in Syria. On this Orthodox Christmas, he's thinking about them. They're part of the Christian minority whose future is uncertain under the new government led by an Islamist fighting group that just toppled the Assad dictatorship.
They are watching, they are seeing, they are expecting, I mean, any changes, any negative changes.
Any changes that might suggest they could be persecuted. Gulisarian takes comfort in the Orthodox traditions that have survived for millennia. So did his church, though it was badly damaged in 2020 during a massive explosion in the Beirut port nearby. More than 200 people died, and Lebanon is still really struggling. Its economy is in tatters, politically it's in gridlock, and it was severely battered by a recent war with Israel. And yet, Gulisarian is still here in Beirut, and the church is still standing.
That's Lebanon, after all, you know?
So, somehow you always make it through.
Yeah.
But on this Christmas, he says he feels weary of the regional wars and the economic woes.
It's a never-ending cycle, I think.
Yet this year, he says he's also affording himself a little holiday cheer.
Let's hope this is the end.
Even if he does not quite believe in his own hopes. Emily Fang, NPR News, Beirut, Lebanon.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Adrian Brody joins us to talk about his role in the 3.5-hour film The Brutalist. Brody says he drew from his mother and grandfather's experiences of immigrating from Hungary to the U.S. to portray a Hungarian Jewish architect and Holocaust survivor who seeks a fresh start in post-World War II America. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From EBSCO, committed to providing colleges and universities with relevant online research databases to ensure student, faculty, and staff success. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from ECMC Foundation, at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We are remembering Jimmy Carter this week, and we have a glimpse of the former president in defeat. Carter, you will recall, won the presidency in 1976 and then lost it in 1980. His defeat was seen as a rejection of him as much as an embrace of his opponent, Ronald Reagan. And for years afterwards, some Democrats running for office didn't even want to be seen with him. Carter eventually went on to a long and high-profile post-presidency, but first he had to dig himself out of a hole. In 2007, Carter came on this program and talked of that experience, starting when he left the White House and went home to Plains, Georgia.
I was more than $1 million in debt. I didn't have a job. We had a business that had collapsed while I was in the White House.
This was the famous peanut farm.
That's right. Well, the peanut farm was still growing, but I had a business that was a warehousing business where I bought peanuts and processed them for sale, and I had a cotton gin. And while I was in the White House, the business kind of went down the drain. So I was shocked after I lost the election to find out I was also had lost my fortune and was deeply in debt. So I sold my business finally and wrote a book called Keeping Faith, a biography of my life in the White House, and eventually worked my way out of the hole. Then the Carter Center was born, and for the last 25 years, my life could not have been more expansive and unpredictable and adventurous and gratifying.
Let me ask about that work, which has taken you around the world. You've been involved in any number of diplomatic missions, official and unofficial, and visits to various countries and observing elections. People have often said of you, and I don't know if you take this as a compliment or perhaps a backhanded compliment, they'll say, well, Jimmy Carter has accomplished more since he left office than he ever did while he was in office. Do you agree with that statement?
Well, I don't disagree with it. I've tried to do the best I could in both cases. When I was in office, we kept our nation at peace. We protected our interests. We never were called upon to drop a bomb or to launch a missile or to fire a bullet at anyone else. We promoted peace for others, like between Israel and Egypt, a treaty that hasn't been violated in a single word now for going on 30 years. We did a lot of good things, but I have to say that the post-presidential years have been much more an opportunity for me and Rosen personally to become involved in the lives of other people around the world. And this has been completely different kind of involvement.
Don't you miss the power?
Sometimes I wish I had the power, yes. But we've learned to do without it. We do more by enticements and by persuasion and trying to inspire the people, recruiting a lot of allies and friends and supporters who have the power or the money. So it's a much more complex way to build up influence than just to exert the power of a great nation. So I can't say that I prefer the power of a president. I think what we have now is in many ways superior.
Former President Jimmy Carter speaking in 2007. He lies in state at the Capitol this week, and we will have live coverage of his funeral. Tomorrow on the program, we have another interview with Jimmy Carter at a controversial moment. We asked him why he was accusing Israel of apartheid.
Other than a handful of scholars, the world had not seen Zora Neale Hurston's final novel until now. The writer and anthropologist was working on the life of Herod the Great when she died in Florida in 1960 at the age of 69.
She never managed to get it published. The manuscript was left in her trunk after she died.
That's Professor Deborah Plant, a scholar specializing in the life and works of Hurston.
People who had been hired to clear out the house that she was living in, they took the trunk out and they were burning the contents of the trunk. Luckily, one of her friends, who was also a deputy sheriff there in Fort Pierce, he was driving by at that time. And seeing the fire, he managed to get a hose nearby and put the fire out.
Plant edited this manuscript. Before that, the manuscript was submitted to the University of Gainesville's Special Collections. It was preserved there until its recent restoration.
There are pages and pages that were missing, and then also pages and pages that were burnt or singed. But at the same time, there were many pages that were still intact. And that was, to me, amazing. It was like almost 400 pages, and maybe a third of that had been exposed to fire and smoke.
The story Hurston wanted to tell focused on Herod, the ancient Roman-appointed king of Judea.
She was interested in researching and writing about the history of the Jewish people after Moses, like what became of their civilization, their culture. And as she was researching it and learning about it, she discovered Herod, and more Herod became a central figure.
Here is Hurston in her own words, read by our producer Destiny Adams in a letter to her editor from 1953.
You have no idea the great amount of research that I have done on this man. No matter who talks about him, friend or foe, Herod is a magnificent character.
Professor Deborah Plant says Hurston hoped to write an historical novel contesting the most widely accepted view of King Herod as a despot.
She wanted people to know who he was, and she wanted people to know that he was not this terrible, oppressive tyrant as he was purported to be, but quite a popular king who ruled for 37 years.
Today's debut of The Life of Herod the Great honors the 134th anniversary of Zora Neale Hurston's birth.
She loved life, and she loved humanity. We want to remember her as a humanitarian who was courageous in her effort to have us see ourselves whole and complete, undiminished.
Plant hopes that much like the character that consumed Hurston until the end of her life, she too is remembered for her many dimensions. This is NPR News.
Rocky Mountain spotted fever is the deadliest tick-borne disease in the U.S. In the Southwest, tribal communities have made progress in preventing deaths from the disease.
The difference I've seen in the past 12, 13 years I've been here, like this time of year, you'd see dogs packed with ticks in their ears.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, How They Did It, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The body of former President Jimmy Carter will be moved from Atlanta, Georgia to Washington, D.C. today. The nation's 39th president will lie in state at the U.S. Capitol Rotunda ahead of his state funeral on Thursday. It will be held at Washington National Cathedral. Carter died on December 29th. At the age of 100, he'll be buried in Plains, Georgia. The Biden administration says a new rule will remove medical debt from Americans' credit reports. NPR's Asma Khalid says the change was announced today by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Tens of millions of people in the United States are saddled with medical bills they cannot pay, sometimes forcing them to drain their savings. Under this new rule, medical debt will no longer be listed on anyone's credit report. The White House says today's rule will remove $49 billion in unpaid medical bills from people's credit reports. This means some people may see their credit scores improve and have an easier time receiving a mortgage. The CFPB has made going after medical debt a priority, but some congressional Republicans have long criticized the agency, and it's not clear what will happen in a new Trump administration. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
The National Weather Service is extending cold weather advisories from the Florida Panhandle to West Texas into New Mexico. This is NPR News. About 45,000 union dock workers on the East Coast of the U.S. as well as the Gulf Coast are threatening to go on strike if a contract agreement isn't reached by January 15th. A main issue is the level of automation at ports from Maine to Texas. Negotiations are restarting today. A new report offers more information about research into fluoride in drinking water and its effects on children. NPR's Ping Huang says about 70% of people in the U.S. get fluoride in their drinking water to prevent cavities.
A few months ago, the National Toxicology Program, part of the National Institutes of Health, released a report on fluoride and children's IQ. Now, government researchers have published details on their analysis in the medical journal JAMA Pediatrics. They looked at dozens of studies, mostly from China and India, and conclude with moderate confidence that some babies and kids exposed to high levels of fluoride may experience neurodevelopmental harm. The effect was found at fluoride levels more than twice what's recommended for the U.S. water supply, and the results are controversial. An accompanying opinion piece says the researchers did not fully consider other studies that cast doubt on the links. But the analysis has spurred opponents of fluoridation to call for a new assessment of its benefits and its risks. Ping Huang, NPR News.
Stocks are higher on Wall Street. The Dow is up 182 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from C3 AI. C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems using any LLM, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. This is Enterprise AI. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. It's been weeks since rebels toppled the Assad regime in Syria and formed a new interim government. That government is already facing a serious challenge. Breadlines, as NPR's Dia Hadid reports from Damascus. Before we begin, please note that some Syrians interviewed for this story only gave their first names or asked not to be named at all. That's because they were worried their words could get them in trouble with the new interim government.
There's a line for men and another for women outside this bakery that pumps out industrial quantities of bread. Each line has dozens of people, and the bread they're hoping to buy costs up to 10 times more than it did under the old Assad regime. The dinner plate-sized pieces of flatbread thump off a conveyor belt onto a table near the counter. One woman hands over money for 48 pieces. It's just a few days' supply for most Syrian families in a country where bread is the staple. There are scenes like this across Damascus. At another bakery, 35-year-old Rahaf, mother to eight, jokes to me that she's only alive because she's not dead. Rahaf, like all the other Syrians I hear from, didn't want to give her full name. They fear reprisals because they're talking about a sensitive topic.
Those bread lines are telling you a story about Syria today, why this Assad government fell, and the challenges that face this new regime.
Joshua Landis is a Syria specialist at the University of Oklahoma. He says bread is so politically sensitive in Syria that the Assad regime heavily subsidized it, but it often wasn't available. Landis says that's partly why Assad was toppled. And if this government can't resolve the bread crisis, it will become both a hunger crisis and a political one.
It's very hard for us to understand how most Syrians are surviving. They're just barely subsisting.
Like Noor, he's 21 but looks 12. Thin, short, gaunt. He's dreamily chewing on a scrap of bread. I'm just resting for a bit, he says. I waited for an hour in line for this. The bread lines and the prices are sensitive for the new regime. I see two men approach Noor. Later, he tells me they've told him not to talk. These bread lines have created their own industry. Poor folks buy up the bread and resell it by the roadside. Among them is 12-year-old Muhammad, whose back aches from standing in line all day. He resells the bread to people like this 33-year-old single mother. She's got young kids at home and she can't waste time standing in line. Despite the new hardship, she says this is better than the Assad regime which detained her husband. He never returned. She says, we're no longer living in fear. She's got faith in this government. And over the weekend, Syrian officials announced that public sector pay would increase by four times to help alleviate the current economic crisis. Analysts say there's a few reasons why the price of bread is increasing. As rebels seized Damascus, the Syrian currency tumbled, in turn pushing up prices. And Russia, which was a close ally of the former Assad regime, used to supply Syria's wheat flour. Now the Reuters news agency says Moscow's halted supplies. But one country has offered help, Ukraine, another of the world's great wheat producers, which also happens to be fighting against Russia. In a recent visit to Damascus, Ukraine's foreign minister, Andriy Sybiha, announced a gift of 500 tons of flour. He says more's on the way. That may depend on the new Syrian government renouncing the former Assad regime's recognition of Russia's annexation of Ukrainian land. Outside the bakeries, people are impatient. We walk down one bread line, and one man tells us to stop recording. It's not clear who he is, but it can also be risky to ask. Okay, I'm done, I tell him. A few feet away, a retired school teacher stops me. He tells me, I've been waiting in this line for 2 hours. He says, this regime told us it's bringing freedom, but we can't buy bread. Dear Hadid, NPR News, Damascus.
How many transgender teenagers are receiving medical care related to gender transitions? Researchers from Harvard just crunched the numbers from insurance claims to find out. Here's NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin.
Republican lawmakers all around the country have moved in the last few years to ban gender-affirming care for transgender youth. That care usually includes puberty-blocking medications and hormone therapy. With all the political attention on this group, Landon Hughes wanted to calculate its size. He's a postdoctoral research fellow at the Harvard School of Public Health.
I think it's important to put numbers to sort of the debates that are currently happening in the public space.
So Hughes worked with colleagues at Harvard and Folks Health, which is a virtual LGBTQ healthcare company. They used a data set of private insurance claims from 2018 to 2022 that included more than 5 million adolescents. Here's what they found.
The total number of youth who had any diagnosis of gender dysphoria was less than 18,000. And among those folks, there were only less than 1,000 that accessed puberty blockers and less than 2,000 that ever had accessed hormones.
So less than 0.1% of teenagers with private insurance in the U.S. are transgender and receive gender-related medicines. The research was published Monday in the journal JAMA Pediatrics. Major medical associations in the U.S., including the American Academy of Pediatrics, support this care. Lindsay Dawson directs LGBTQ health policy at the health research organization KFF and was not involved in the study. She was impressed by its sample size.
It echoes past work that has found that gender-affirming medical care is relatively rare among all trans and non-binary people, but especially so among adolescents.
Republicans have pledged to enact a number of policies that would affect this small group, including a federal ban on gender-affirming care for youth. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Artificial intelligence has an energy problem. It needs a lot of power. A look at AI's insatiable energy appetite and the damage it does next time on Here and Now.
Our phones hold a lot of stuff, right? Grocery lists, music, pet photos. They also help us stay informed. Listen live on this station's website or NPR.org.
Good morning, me Martinez. The real-life donkey that inspired Trek's beloved sidekick has gone to the great swamp in the sky. The Jerusalem donkey named Perry has died at the age of 30. He started as an emotional support animal for polo ponies at Stanford before becoming a global icon by modeling for DreamWorks animators creating the movie franchise. Since his death, tributes have poured in online showing that Donkey does indeed have friends. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. By definition, surfers spend a lot of time in the water and so have many reasons to want to keep those waters pristine. But surfboards are often made of environmentally unfriendly materials. A Wisconsin-based surfer is on a quest to change that and change people's assumptions about surfing. Susan Bentz with member station WUWM has the story.
There are more than 10,000 miles of coastline along the Great Lakes, so it's often called the country's third coast. Peak season for surfing is in the fall, winter, and early spring, when winds can whip up impressive waves. So on a chilly fall morning, folks in wetsuits came to ride the swells, and Ken Cole showed up.
Here we go.
Cole's love of surfing began in Hawaii, where he was working on his psychology dissertation. There's just one problem as far as Cole's concerned. Surfers love the waters, but typically use surfboards that ultimately contribute to plastic waste that can be harmful to oceans and the Great Lakes. Although there's momentum for more eco-friendly equipment, Cole says most boards have polyurethane foam cores and are coated with fiberglass, both non-biodegradable. If they break down in the water, fish and other aquatic life ingest them. If boards end up in landfills, their toxins can leach, compromising ecosystems in their path. Cole says the industry is trying to change.
But a lot of their focus is on packaging, on repurposed foam. But repurposed foam still relies on foam. Even those that are doing greener boards are still heavily relying on fiberglass.
Cole jumped aboard a movement to create surfboards that won't leave toxic waste in their wake. He started by wrapping his boards using large coffee bags made of jute, eliminating the use of fiberglass. In his basement shop, he moves boxes to show off his surfboard drawings and other creations.
This was like a flat pack box that when I lectured at one of our local schools, at the end I stood on that, basically showed that it would support the weight of a 205-pound man.
The box is strong because it's made of a composite material Cole created, a combination of jute and palm sheath. And he asked a couple of engineers to look at what he'd come up with.
Through a lot of trial and error and testing how to really prep the leaf, we figured out the right way to make the bond really strong.
The big test came on that chilly autumn morning as waves rolled across Lake Michigan. Ted Burdett, an industrial designer, was on hand to watch. He created a 3D model of the surfboard and designed the board's internal skeleton using Cole's composite material instead of foam.
It's one of the heavier boards, but I think what we're going to see is that supplies a lot of awesome momentum.
And with the waves approaching, Cole started paddling into it and then popped up on the board riding along the face of the wave. Minutes later, when he comes back to shore, both men shout with childlike delight.
In the pocket.
Nice! That is awesome. Bring it.
Yeah.
So it works.
Cole says it's like the thrill the Wright brothers must have felt when they flew the aircraft they built near Kitty Hawk, North Carolina.
And this was surfing's Kitty Hawk. I truly believe that. Unless there's somebody else doing a Kitty Hawk board, which I don't think they are.
Cole won't be abandoning his psychology practice, but plans to funnel energy into inspiring other people who make surfboards or even other products to use his composite material or to come up with their own eco-friendly ideas.
If I can do it in my garage, you know, Ted shot my basement and it surfed, what else can be done? That's really the question.
Enough reflection, he says. Cole and Burdett head out to catch some waves while they last. For NPR News, I'm Susan Bentz along Lake Michigan.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The Republic of Sudan in Northeast Africa claims that nearly two dozen mercenaries from Colombia were killed in November fighting in the Sudanese civil war. The news took many Colombians by surprise, but as John Otis reports, a growing number of Colombians are fighting and dying in conflicts all over the world.
That's the sound of government soldiers in Sudan rifling through the papers of a Colombian mercenary who they claim went missing in action following a drone attack in the Darfur region. In a video posted online, the soldiers display the passport of Christian Lomana, a former Colombian army soldier who they say was fighting for Sudanese rebels. Later, they called one of Lombana's relatives back in Colombia to tell her what happened. All told, 22 Colombian mercenaries were killed, according to the Sudanese government, which quickly received an apology from Colombia. But with conflicts raging in the Middle East, Ukraine, and elsewhere, experienced former soldiers are in high demand. And Colombia has a surplus of them, thanks to the many decades its army and police have been battling Marxist rebels and drug traffickers.
It's not just the training, but it's the combat experience. And this is where the Colombians are far and away ahead of most militaries in the world.
That's Jeremy McDermott, co-founder of Insight Crime, a group that investigates organized crime in Latin America. He says there are very few well-paying jobs in Colombia for ex-soldiers. That's why some accept offers to fight abroad, often for just a few thousand dollars per month.
They are very cheap because, you know, if you wanted to hire a British or an American with anything like the kind of combat experience that the Colombians have got, you are having to double that number and then some.
But it can all go very wrong. In 2021, police in Haiti rounded up 26 Colombians accused of assassinating that country's president, Jovenel Moïse. The detainees claimed to have been hired as security guards and said they were duped into taking part in the killing. One of the Colombians was sentenced to life in prison. Former Colombian soldiers have also ended up working for Mexican drug cartels. Others thought they were headed for security jobs in Dubai, only to end up fighting for anti-government militias in Sudan. In an interview with the Colombian news site La Silla Vacía, one of the Colombians in Sudan said, "Here, we're not even mercenaries, we're just bandits." Luis Gilberto Murillo, Colombia's foreign minister, pins much of the blame on shadowy private security firms. They come here and recruit people, sometimes through trickery, then send them off to wars that have nothing to do with us, he said. Murillo wants Colombia to sign a 1989 UN convention that bans the hiring of mercenaries. But some analysts say the Bogota government needs to increase benefits for military vets who often fall on hard times. That's what happened to Luis Medina. After leaving the army, he was barely scraping by picking coffee in southern Colombia, according to his sister Ana. Then, she says, a letter arrived inviting Medina to fight with the Ukrainian army against Russian invaders. Medina jumped at the chance to earn $3,000 a month. In this video he sent to his sister, Medina ducks for cover in a Ukrainian trench. Indeed, he was constantly under fire and decided to return to Colombia after just 6 months. Yet his brief stint as a soldier of fortune left him a marked man. His flight home in July included a layover in Venezuela, which is an ally of Vladimir Putin. Medina was promptly arrested and turned over to Russian authorities. That's Medina being interrogated in a Moscow prison, where he is now awaiting trial on charges of being a mercenary. For NPR News, I'm John Otis in Bogota, Colombia.
Special elections in Virginia today will decide if Democrats can maintain their slim majority in the state legislature, which they have used to challenge Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin's plans. Republicans are hoping for a couple of long-shot wins. WAMU's Margaret Barthel reports.
Virginia Democrats just narrowly control the General Assembly. The House of Delegates and the Senate could each end up in a tie if Democrats lose a seat. And in the Senate, an even split would mean the Republican Lieutenant Governor would have a tie-breaking vote on bills. The focus is on two seats in Loudoun County, in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. Democrats won about 60% of the vote there in recent elections. But Republicans hope to turn that around. Tumai Harding is the GOP nominee for state senate. She says she's fighting, quote, far-left madness, wants to keep transgender students out of girls' bathrooms and sports, and opposes localities adopting immigrant sanctuary policies.
My main concern is keeping everyone's children and communities safe, and it just boils down to that.
She says she got into politics after she and other parents fought to have a teacher fired for sexually harassing students. Facing her is Democrat Kanan Srinivasan, who says he turned to politics after being refused Medicaid after an accident. He served in the House of Delegates and on the state Medicaid board. He says a Democratic Senate is needed to codify voting rights, same-sex marriage, and abortion access. And he has experience.
I'm known for a brand of politics in Richmond that is getting things done.
In an expected low turnout election, the candidates are relying on their base to get to the polls. David Ramadan is a political science professor at George Mason University who formerly represented the area as a moderate Republican.
There's some messaging on the left on abortion and women's rights. There's some messaging on the right on immigration and support of President Trump. But these are truly bare-bone, door-knocking, get-out-the-vote campaigns.
He's skeptical Republicans can pull off an upset given the district's blue history, but anything could happen. Heavy snow in the area could play a role, too. For NPR News, I'm Margaret Barthel in Arlington, Virginia.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez.
And old man Moses did.
We believe.
Oh, fuck it.
We believe.